IFPRI presents the 23rd Annual Martin J. Forman Memorial Lecture, Stepping into the Sun, Successes and Constraints from On the Ground, held on September 27, 2013 in Washington, D.C. Speaker, Sean K. Baker, Nutrition in the Global Development Program, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Thank you, everyone. It's much easier to give a lecture in front of people you don't know than colleagues with whom I worked for many years. When IFPRI invited me to give this lecture, I was sincerely humbled. And then when I did a bit more research on the people who preceded me in giving this lecture, I went from feeling humbled to feeling outright trepidation. But I must confess that even though I knew of Dr. Forman's legacy, I actually didn't know that many details about his life and his contributions. And as I started digging in a bit more into his life, I realized just how incredibly indebted we are to his leadership and how much impact he's had on many of the programs I spent a good chunk of my life implementing. I was struck by two particularly, and I'll start with one. His role in developing the evidence base for vitamin A's role in child survival. I checked with one of the pioneers of vitamin A research, and he affirmed that not only was Dr. Forman's role instrumental, but that, and I will quote here, if it were not for Marty Forman, there would never have been any vitamin A work. I also learned that not only was he brilliant technically, but that he was a very smooth political operator. And when then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger was preparing to address the World Food Conference in 1974, Dr. Forman was asked to draft some talking points. I think we've all been in a situation to draft talking points for the higher-ups. And one of these talking points was a U.S. commitment to eradicate vitamin A deficiency globally. And Secretary Kissinger picked up that talking point and made a public commitment. Well, Dr. Forman knew that it wasn't just a question of getting political commitment, but you needed to turn that political commitment into cash. And so he used that to convince the USAID administrator to make the investments in the vitamin A research. And today, vitamin A programs, as we know, are central to saving children's lives. And vitamin A supplementation is one of the interventions that the nutrition community can boast has actually been taken to scale. The latest global report indicates that 72% of children are getting supplemented every 6 months in countries where vitamin A deficiency is a public health problem, and that the most vulnerable countries are doing even better, with 82% coverage every 6 months. So to the Forman family here present today, I think you should take great pride that his leadership and tenacity mean that many millions of children are alive today who would have died before their fifth birthday. Thank you. Unfortunately, looking back, it seems that the period that Dr. Forman was leading USAID's nutrition efforts corresponds to a relative golden age that fell into senescence over the last several decades. While there have been some successes, such as vitamin A supplementation, many of us on the front lines have felt like voices in the wilderness, with the breakthroughs being few and far between. As you know, there were many shocks in 2008 that jolted the world again into action, notably the global food price crisis, the Copenhagen Consensus Report, and perhaps most importantly, the Lancet series on undernutrition. Others have spoken at this lecture on the progress of the Scaling Up Nutrition Initiative, the Scaling Up Nutrition Movement, as it's called, that was spawned in large part by these shocks. And 2013 has been a pivotal year with landmark events such as the Nutrition for Growth Summit in London, the launch of the 2013 Lancet series, and as Shingen has just said, the Scaling Up Nutrition Global Gathering earlier this week at the United Nations that brought together 41 countries and one state from India. That's where we get to the confusion between 41 and 42. That have formally committed themselves to the scaling up nutrition movement. It brought together representatives of those countries and global leaders. So I am very optimistic that after decades of hiatus, the global community, and most importantly, high burden countries, are stepping up to the challenge of malnutrition in a way that Dr. Foreman's legacy deserves. In addition to the technical analysis that was provided by the Lancet authors in 2008, there was a political analysis that the international nutrition system was broken. My own analysis is that we spent often as much energy fighting among ourselves as fighting malnutrition. 5 years later, the 2013 Lancet series concluded that there had been major progress. And I think, as demonstrated this week in New York, that is undeniable. However, we may have been misbehaved before, but I fear we may have overcorrected and become too well-behaved. Let me remind you of the numbers that come out of the Lancet 2013. 3.1 million children die each year because of undernutrition, 45% of under five deaths. It also has demonstrated what undernutrition's contribution is to maternal death and neonatal mortality. And we know also just how much the malnutrition impacts on children's long-term productivity and mental capacity. Surely these numbers illustrate one of the great moral failings of our time. In another part of my life, I am quite involved in HIV and AIDS work, and I think we need to learn from that community. When HIV exploded on the landscape, it created a whole groundswell of activism, and this outrage was channeled into funding and action. Funding and action that have started to turn the tide on the HIV pandemic. I think the nutrition community needs to mobilize to translate these horrific numbers and the constructive outrage that will mobilize the scale of action on the ground that will truly position us to win the fight against malnutrition. As I was rereading my notes before this lecture, I was thinking maybe I need to tone down the outrage comments. And then Wednesday evening, I read an article in the New York Times that talked about the epidemic of obesity in dogs in the US, and the whole industry that has sprung up around diet food for dogs, spas for dogs, personal coaches for dogs to get them to thin down. I think a world that can combat obesity in dogs can surely be outraged that 3.1 million children die every year because of undernutrition. And now I want to turn to share with you my perspective on what is working on the ground and what needs to happen on the ground in order to translate this incredible global commitment into action. And I will start from a personal perspective, sharing a tale of a field trip I made in Niger in 2011 with a journalist. One of our stops was a government-run health center that had services for treatment of severe acute malnutrition. And we met one child, Alu Muhammad, and his mother. Alu was severely emaciated and had almost lost his left eye from keratomalacia, the most visible outcome of vitamin A deficiency. A pretty grim situation. But in fact, Alu's story illustrates both what we have done well in nutrition and where we are failing. Now, over the years, I've learned to become an optimist, so I'm going to start with the positive signs that this represents. It's important to note that Alu was not from Niger, but from across the border in Nigeria. The nurse at the health center in Niger said that, who had been working in the health system in Niger for decades, said this is the first time in years she'd ever seen a clinical signs of vitamin A deficiency. And she went on to talk about how well the vitamin A supplementation program was in Niger. Unfortunately, in Nigeria next door, it is less efficient. And indeed, we know from the numbers that Niger is one of the pioneers in vitamin A supplementation in sub-Saharan Africa. It started mass distribution of vitamin A capsules in 1997, connected with National Immunization Days. And in 1999, became the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to achieve high coverage of vitamin A twice per year. And that success in Niger catalyzed a whole wave of child health days throughout Africa. Secondly, what's illustrated by this example is that Niger has tremendously ramped up treatment of malnourished children. Alu's mom said that the reason she came across the border was that she had heard the clinic on the other side could treat her child. In 2012, over 300,000 children in Niger were screened and treated for severe acute malnutrition, all through government health facilities, unlike 2005, when almost all the capacity to do so had to be flown in. This is a massive increase in capacity. And although we did not see it on this particular trip, the one cooking oil producer in Niger also produces vitamin A fortified cooking oil. And Niger made fortification of cooking oil and flour mandatory in 2012 as part of a regional initiative of the 15-country ECOWAS, Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. Stepping back at the political level, there's also been a huge transformation. Not many years ago, speaking about food insecurity and malnutrition in Niger were politically taboo. But the new, relatively new, democratically elected government has launched a presidential initiative called Nigerians Nourish Nigerians, and became a very early adherent to the Scaling Up Nutrition movement. It signed up on February 14, 2011. There has been huge progress. Unfortunately, on many other fronts, we are failing, despite some noble efforts. Because I feel even though there is a moral imperative to identify and treat children like Alu who have become severely malnourished, I think there's an even greater imperative that we never let any child get into that condition. Areas where I feel we have particularly failed are in protection and promotion of breastfeeding, complementary feeding, and women's nutrition. In Niger, there have been some quite remarkable targeted efforts that have shown impressive gains in timely initiation and exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months. But nationally, exclusive breastfeeding rates at 6 months remain low, only 11%. For mother's nutrition, I think it's telling that something as basic as iron folic acid supplementation is reaching less than 10% of women. And Niger is no outlier in that. And in the area of complementary feeding, I think we as nutritionists need to do a bit of soul searching, because I feel that we've actually been too often guilty of ignoring the economic realities. One study in an agriculturally rich region of Niger shows that 64% of families cannot afford a nutritionally adequate diet for the young children in the peak of the agricultural season. So I think in addition to behavior change communication programs, which are essential for complementary feeding, we also need to see how do we get to mothers the additional resources they need, be it cash, be it food, be it product, or some combination of the three, so that they can apply this knowledge. Scaling up these nutrition-specific interventions can do a lot for Alu and his mother, and the millions like them. However, it's also clear those interventions cannot do it all alone. If families do not have access to safe drinking water, to sanitation, to nutritiously adequate food, then we are still failing them. I think we need to be far more purposeful in truly leveraging the other sectors to deliver on nutrition. Now, I focused on Niger for this story, and while progress across sub-Saharan Africa has been uneven, Niger is not that much of an outlier. There are many countries making major strides across the continent. I think, as an illustration of the increasing political commitment, over two-thirds of the countries that have joined the Scaling Up Nutrition movement, 28 out of the 41, so if you're questioning my denominator, are from Africa. Analyzing both the successes I've spoken of and where I see we have had failures, I see six major constraints going forward that we need to address in order to realize the promise of scaling up nutrition. Firstly, we need to invest seriously and purposely in on-the-ground capacity to deliver. For me, capacity could be summarized by having the right people with the right training in the right places with the right supporting environment to do the right things. I think that capacity building has been the orphan intervention in the nutrition agenda, with at best piecemeal efforts and more often none at all. I was very heartened at the events in New York around Scaling Up Nutrition Global Gathering earlier this week that the capacity agenda emerged far more explicitly as an area we need to address seriously. I think one of the most encouraging examples I heard in New York was from Tanzania, their commitment to deploy a nutritionist in every one of their over 160 health districts, and about 80% of that has actually been realized. And Shingen spoke about this surge of political commitment, and my second major issue we need to address is to really see this political commitment translated into resources. The Nutrition for Growth Summit in London earlier this year is a great first step, but even with that, the resource gaps remain huge. And to me, this also links directly to the sort of nutrition leadership capacity we need to nurture, technically sound, but also politically savvy. Again, I was inspired by learning more about Dr. Foreman, who had that magical combination of technical brilliance, vision, and the political astuteness to get stuff done. Thirdly, we need to be much more concentrated on what I call the science of how. And to me, the most unacceptable aspect of the global tragedy of undernutrition is that we know so much of what needs to be done, but with the few exceptions I have noted, we have not disciplined ourselves to understand how to deliver these interventions at the scale that will truly change the face of nutrition. We need to change the incentive structures for researchers so that figuring how to make things work is as publishable and meritorious as more basic research. I think we can do more to purposely forge relationships between research institutions and implementers to really unleash the potential of proven interventions. I've already mentioned my fourth point. We clearly need to do more to leverage other sectors. I think that we all recognize that this is where we have the greatest knowledge deficit on the what side of the equation. I feel if we look at the agricultural sector, to focus in on that, that this is where that the agricultural sector is now calling our bluff. Our advocacy has worked in many cases, and then the Minister of Agriculture turns to you and say, great, so what do I do, and how much do I budget? And we don't have a lot of answers. As much as I love orange flesh sweet potatoes, and I've dedicated a huge amount of my life to promoting orange flesh sweet potatoes, I can only respond to the agricultural minister orange flesh sweet potatoes so many times without looking pretty foolish. We need more answers. I heard last week at the International Union of Nutritional Sciences, and I did not verify this, but it sounded good, so I'll repeat it, that there have been now more reviews of the literature on the links between agriculture and nutrition than there have been original studies. And I applaud the body of work that is now being undertaken, much led by the CGIAR system, to make agriculture more nutrition sensitive. But perhaps we need to call a moratorium on more reviews until we can harvest the results of these new studies. Again, I was somewhat sobered by my research on Dr. Foreman. Among other things, I came across a publication, to which Rebecca actually referred already, where he was one of the editors. Others were Per Pinstrup Anderson and Ellen Berg, if my memory serves me correctly, called International Agricultural Research in Human Nutrition, published in 1984. Do the maths. I find it sobering and humbling is that some of us working on the links between agriculture and nutrition think we've discovered something new. To me, it underscores the urgency of delivering on this knowledge agenda so that we can try to catch up for a couple of lost decades. I also want to stress that while we do not know everything about what needs to be done to make other sectors do more for nutrition, we do know some things. And this is where I come back to my second point, is that we need to be as focused on figuring out how to deliver as what to deliver. I focus here on the agricultural sector, but I think there are very similar challenges and opportunities across other sectors. The fifth constraint I want to highlight is in the area of measurement. I think in the nutrition field, you don't go to any conference without hearing people lament about how difficult it is to measure very basic indicators that we need to guide programs and policy and permit course correction. To me, this is more a reflection of lack of prioritization of nutrition versus truly insurmountable obstacles. I'll take the liberty again of comparing to the HIV field, where we're now measuring with home test kits things we didn't even know existed a couple decades ago. I think if we're going to be serious about nutrition, we need to be serious about measuring it and really ensure that countries and their partners have timely, quality, actionable data. The last challenge I want to underscore is maintaining the commitment. As we all know, politicians, be they in Abuja, Delhi, or Washington, can have very short memories and be very eager to move on to the next issue. But here we're taking on some pretty systemic failures to deliver. And even though there can be some quick wins, we all need to be committed to this agenda for the long term. I'll come again back to vitamin A programs as an example, because I think they're a good illustration of both the unacceptably long pathway from turning scientific evidence into action and the necessity of sustained engagement to make things happen. So I'd start my accounting in the research agenda on vitamin A in the mid-70s, a surge of community trials showing the mortality impact in the mid-80s, the meta-analyses of the 90s, but no country in Africa actually achieved twice-yearly coverage of supplementation at high enough levels to have an impact on mortality until 1999, and it didn't become generalized practice in Africa in 2005. So depending where you start your clock, we're talking of several decades to get science into action that's saving children's lives. I think that's unacceptable. And without the tenacity and vision of USAID under Dr. Foreman's leadership, and then the very sustained commitment of the Canadian government over the last more than decade and a half, we would not have made this progress. So the lessons I draw from this history are that we need to get much better at translating new evidence into programs and sustain the commitment if we are truly going to unleash the potential of improved nutrition to save lives and ensure brilliant futures for the next generation. So I come back, I think as many of us, from the Scaling Up Nutrition Global Gathering early this week, really excited and optimistic. I'm also very fearful. We are in a wave of the greatest enthusiasm for nutrition I have seen in my professional life. And now we all need to step up to the plate to empower countries to deliver. I usually close anything I say with a quote from Helen Keller. As Shingen said, I worked for Helen Keller International for 19 years. However, today I wanted to share with you one of my favorite quotes from Nelson Mandela. He was referring to the Millennium Development Goals when he queried us, "Will our generation's legacy be more than a series of broken promises?" The promise embodied by the Scaling Up Nutrition movement is huge. A fitting legacy to Dr. Foreman is that we seize this momentum and deliver on these promises. The lives and well-being of so many of the women and children we serve depend on it. We cannot be the generation who breaks these promises. Thank you.